Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm your host, Alex West, with...
Andrea Subisati.
Oh, my God, that was so scary.
Oh, God,
it was like a horrible vision of the future of being an old hag and, you know, being obsessed with beauty. Oh, God. We're here to talk to you today about something that we've actually talked about since the beginning of this podcast between Andrea and myself, which was witches. We'd always kind of wanted to do an episode about witches, really since December 2012, figuring out how we wanted to talk about them, what films to talk about them, and how to really attack the whole idea of witches, because they're such an omnipresence in horror culture. I mean, if you think about Halloween, if you go to like a dollar store near you, there's so much witch iconography, and it doesn't really have a basis in anything except to be, you know, it's witch and it's scary and we all identify with it. So the idea of examining witches in film proper was something that I think we both thought was very interesting and I think actually kind of necessary to the discussion of them.
That's right. And even though we're not a feminist podcast per se, we kind of are a feminist horror podcast. And so the witchcraft episode has been something we've been toying with for a long time. So we're really excited to finally get into it. Now, what we've decided to do, there are so many great movies out there on witches. So many. We had to limit it to three. We want to keep these episodes down to between an hour and a half long. So we chose three movies. And we're going to start in 1996 with Andrew Fleming's film, The Craft.
To the other kids at St. Bernard Academy, they were the girls who didn't belong.
Whatever you do, stay away from them.
Why?
They're witches.
But after years of being on the outside...
Why'd you lie about me?
I don't want to go out with you again. Please, stop begging. It's pathetic.
Four girls are about to discover the dark side.
You ever heard of invoking the spirit?
Black magic. Less fetishistic support. Less fetishistic support.
We can make things happen. I mean, this is it. This is real.
This spring, Columbia Pictures welcomes you to the Witching Hour.
Check it out, her spell is working. Sit.
The Craft.
Girls, watch out for those weirdos.
We are the weirdos, mister.
So The Craft is a story of a young girl named Sarah who is transplanted by her father and her stepmother to California. She starts a new school, she's kind of on her own, and from this very outset, from the way the film is shot, and from the way we are aligned with Sarah, we understand that there's something just a little bit different about her. Now, the school she goes to is kind of your typical mean girls high school. There are the popular people, and then there are the weirdos. Now, the weirdos, in this case, happen to be Bonnie, Nancy, and Rochelle. The start of a coven of witches, or practicing Wicca, if you will. Now, Sarah comes to the school, has a brief interaction with these three girls, and they kind of shun her. It's very weird, very awkward. And she falls in with a young man named Chris, who's played by everyone's favorite 90s boyfriend, Skeet Ulrich. After Sarah declines to, you know, maybe not have sex with him right off the bat, Sarah comes to school the next day only to find she's been labeled a slut. So now that she is a social outcast, she now falls in with the other three outcasts. They all discover they have a mutual love of witchcraft and that Sarah actually seems to be a real natural at this. So they form a really deep friendship and bond through witchcraft. And just as they start to rectify the things that are going wrong in their lives, Bonnie, Rochelle, and Nancy all seem to go a little power hungry. So we have our girl Sarah left on the outside of this coven, wanting to leave it and wanting to stop any more craziness from happening, especially after Nancy kills Chris. The whole thing comes to a head when Sarah is attacked in her own home by these three girls, and they've played a glamour where, you know, they show that her father and stepmother have died in a plane crash. And it is that time when Sarah realizes her true inner powers, which comes from her mother, who is apparently a natural witch and was very powerful in her own right. So Sarah is able to draw on that power and defeat the other three girls, and actually sends Nancy to a mental institution. The film ends with Bonnie and Rochelle coming to Sarah and saying, you know, oh, do you still have any powers? We don't. We're super sorry about everything that happened. And Sarah playing it off. And then it ends with the fact that Sarah is actually still a full and completely powerful witch.
Right. Now, before we get into the analysis, I think we just have to point out that this movie has been extremely influential in both my and Alex's lives. And I think if you talk to any horror fan, any female film fan around our age, they probably have an acute fondness for this film. Now, my fondness for this film, obviously, I was a horror fan, so it was just Clueless mixed with horror, right? As these were the dark girls. And also because I went to a Catholic high school, which had these uniforms, and, you know, being one of a duo of the only two goth girls in the entire school, I really took to this movie. This movie became my soundtrack and my fashion sense. And yeah, this movie was a really big deal to me. So on its surface, it's just a really fun teen movie. But when we get into it, as we are about to, there's a lot going on.
I think I actually may have worn out my first VHS copy of this movie when I was a kid, just because I watched it so much. I think there were a few sleepovers. This is kind of pegged as a big sleepover movie, especially for girls. But I watched it a lot on my own. And there was a Wicca shop up the street from where I lived when I was growing up at that time. So I like bought candles and thought I was fancy. And then those candles were too expensive. So then I went to Pier 1 and bought those candles and thought I was still powerful.
You know how to use candles?
Yeah, you light the wick.
So as the story goes, the filmmakers consulted with actual modern-day Wiccans to inform this film, and the scenes where Sarah and her friends go into the magic shop, everything is very, you know, they don't embellish the witchness, they don't glamorize it, they don't fetishize it, they really deliver it as a nature-worshipping religion that it is.
True magic is neither black nor white. It's both because nature is both, loving and cruel, all at the same time.
That point really goes into what actually Andrea was just talking about, in that she went to a Catholic high school. One of the things that's made very clear from the outset is that those three girls are the other. They are outcasts. They are different. And it's made even more clear in the fact that they are goth and they are witches, but also that in the Catholic high school, the film is always shot with this glare of statue of Jesus watching over them. And it's a bit ominous and it's very strange. And it's really in contrast to what these four women are doing with their spare time.
That's right. And Catholicism, which is very androcentric and doesn't offer a whole lot of power to women, is set in stark contrast to Wicca, which is the exact opposite. However, it bears mention that Manon is completely fictitious. Manon is the one singular deity that they decide is the ultimate power.
He's a football field, right?
Something like that.
It's like God and the devil. I mean, it's everything. It's the trees, it's the ground, it's the rocks, it's the moon. It's everything.
It's nature.
No. If God and the devil were playing football, Manon would be the stadium that they played on. It would be the sun that shone down on them.
So as a team of outsiders, they each have their own kind of little bone to grind. For Sarah, she's really jilted by that whole Chris situation. He humiliated her. She was brand new to the school, and already her reputation is shit. So her one plea to Manon was that he falls in love with her. Bonnie is a survivor of a horrible fire and has scars all over her back, which makes her really meek and timid. Rochelle is being terrorized by a bully on her swim team named Laura. And Nancy greedily just asks for all the power of Manon. Now, the lady at the magic shop warns them that whatever they cast out will come back to them times three. And that's pretty much exactly what happens.
The only good or bad is in the heart of the witch. Life keeps a balance on its own. You understand?
Not really.
Well, then understand this. Whatever you send out, you get back times three.
Wait. We didn't read that in any book.
No. It's part of a basic spiritual truth. Said in many ways, in many faiths. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Well, if I may, I don't disagree that Nancy gets greedy, but if you look at the kind of problems that all these different girls face, Rochelle is facing racial prejudice. Bonnie, and to a certain extent, I would say also Sarah, are falling short in the boys don't like us department. Nancy is a victim of her class. She's kind of labeled as white trash. And actually, Nancy is the character we have most investment in her inner life, in her life outside of them and outside of school, because we have all these scenes with her in her trailer, and then she kills her, I guess, de facto stepdad, and they get all this money. There's something that's very powerful to her about the gaining of money and that kind of status that it gives.
These girls are set up to be all kind of disenfranchised in a certain way, sort of tied up with high school popularity, and I want to be popular, and I want to be liked by boys, and I just want to be pretty. And so we can kind of sympathize with these girls, but Nancy, who asks for all the power of Manon, and it seems greedy because it's not the little high school wishes that the rest of them had. Now, Sarah has her own baggage. She survived a suicide attempt.
What's up with that?
I slit my wrist.
Sorry.
What'd you do it with?
With that kitchen knife.
You even did it the right way.
Yeah.
Which, frankly, I always found a little bit disingenuous. Like, I understood it in the movie, but she really doesn't seem like a depressed girl at all. If anything, she's got her head really straight. She goes out with the first cute guy who pays attention to her, and she falls in with the wrong crowd, but she calls them out when they're doing shitty shit. And anyway, I feel like Nancy is ultimately the villain and punished because she wanted more than the rest of the girls were willing to settle for in terms of what they could get with their powers.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point you just made about Sarah, that she has the level head and enjoys it while she can and has fun with it. But when things start going really bad and she realizes the imbalance that they have created, that's when she stands up and tells them to their faces that this isn't right. And then when they don't do anything, that's when she leaves this group. So I think that's an important point to keep in mind for the whole Sarah versus Nancy argument. And I know that especially through the second half of this film, you know, there are apparently a lot of problems with feminism and the feminist critique of this film, that the girls all wind up not getting along. But I think it's also more of a condemnation of an abuse of power rather than it is a condemnation of female friendship.
It's a sisterhood of outcasts, and when they find that they're not those outcasts, when they don't have that pain to commiserate with each other, it all kind of falls apart. Now, the other big contrast of the film between Sarah and Nancy is the fact that Sarah is a natural witch. I feel sorry for her because she lost her mother, but she also gained all these natural powers from her mother, and she's white, middle class, and lovely. And then here's Nancy, who has nothing, and she is so hungry for all this power, and she also kind of wears her witchcraft in a really artificial and commodified sense. She kind of gets edgier as her power grows, you know, her hair gets wilder and she wears a bit more spikes and her lipstick gets blacker, and you know what Firuza Balk looks like, any more intense, I don't even, her head would be on fire.
What I think is really interesting, because I totally agree about the portrayal of Nancy, that it does become more wild and crazy, and it starts off in a kind of wild and crazy place. But what's interesting is that Nancy, Firuza Balk's character, has a history with Chris, and he seemed to have spread all those same kind of rumors and maybe given her an STD or two before Sarah even came into the picture. When Sarah casts her love spell, it of course works. And after it works, and it's funny for a couple scenes, then it gets scary. It gets really scary. He turns into a stalker. He can't eat. He can't sleep. There's no life outside of Sarah for him. But Nancy seems to be pretty jealous about this, the fact that Sarah cast this specific spell and it worked, and now she's getting all this seemingly positive attention from Chris. So what Nancy does is, after Sarah has rejected and is very fearful of Chris, Nancy goes to a house party and then drags Chris upstairs saying, oh, Sarah's up there, she wants to talk to you. And then Nancy pulls a glamour on herself to make her appear as Sarah. And then things get a little hot and heavy until Chris winds up going out a window.
That's right. And it makes Nancy a really interesting villain in this film, because she says a lot of powerful things, and a lot of the shit that she stands for is entirely valid. And considering her socioeconomic position and her hardship and stuff that she's been through, you really tend to feel for her. When she comes after Chris, I don't know if it's that she's jealous of Sarah, but I think she just does not want to see Chris happy. She wants to see him punished for victimizing the women of their school. And when she comes after him in that bedroom, I just got goosebumps.
You are nothing. You are shit. You don't exist. The only way you know how to treat women is by treating them like whores. When you're the whore, and that's gonna stop! Do you understand? You understand what I'm saying?
I'm sorry.
He's sorry! Oh, he's sorry! He's sorry! Sorry! He's sorry! He's sorry! He's sorry! Sorry, Maya!
There are so many guys that I've dated that I would love to hire for Uza Balk and, like, make her go do that to them. So as we touched on earlier, one of the fascinating things about The Craft is that, well, they were very invested in portraying Wicca as a real religion with, you know, a real presence in our contemporary culture. They also got this huge fact. It's not, I guess, wrong to them, but it's so inaccurate that it's really bizarre. I actually remember being confused as a kid, having seen this movie a bunch of times and then getting some books about Wicca out from the library and reading about it. And I kept thinking I'd see Manon. I'd read about this guy who can be a football field. That's the most ridiculous thing in the world. But he can be all these things, and he's like the ultimate godlike deity figure. But the thing is that no one seems to have a grasp of what this Manon character is. And I think, in fact, for a film that's so much about women and so about that journey from teenagerhood to adulthood and that accepting of responsibility, the fact that this overlord figure is referred to as he. Now, what I thought was fascinating about this on the rewatch was that Nancy obviously kind of goes off the deep end when she takes in all the power of Manon. And it starts off fun, and then it goes really bad. And now, when they're attacking Sarah, Sarah invokes Manon, but this is my reading. Because she is a natural witch, she has so much of her mother in her. And, you know, it's even sensed from the woman in the Wicca store that she has this natural power, and it actually comes from a feminine place rather than the masculine place where Nancy got it from. So I think there's a lot of problematic things with that, but I like to believe that the ultimate notion is that the natural understanding of yourself as a woman is ultimately the bigger triumph than taking power from a man. Remember, we're not a feminist podcast.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of problematic because in that way, I feel like The Craft almost reifies a fear of feminine power. Like, you can accept a feminine power in terms of nature, and if you want to do your healing and burn your candles, that's just fine. But if you want to take over, if you want to be really strong, if you want to bring down the patriarchy and go after the asshole who gave you syphilis or whatever, then you are going to have to pay for that times three. And I thought the fact that Manon represented a very male power, and it was a power that corrupted Nancy, as opposed to Sarah's maternal feminine power, which is so much just sweeter. She just wants a boyfriend. It's kind of problematic, but I love this movie too much to really let that take over.
And I do agree with that. I think Andrea is absolutely right, and that Sarah comes from initial place of maybe wanting Chris to actually like her and be her boyfriend, just to see how that all plays out. But if we take this as one of the things I'm most likely to compare it to, like a fairy tale, Sarah's the princess who actually overcomes everything on her own terms, and actually her prince dies because he's a fucking asshole. And the fact that she's on her own at the end, and she's still powerful, but she's not braggy about it, and it's all okay. We know that Sarah will be okay because of the fact that she accepted the power and has rejected the toxic people out of her life.
Right, and speaking of Chris, another thing that I found kind of problematic about this film that I didn't question when I was a teenager, but looking back, I'm kind of like, what the fuck? She has cast a love spell on Chris, and we know that whatever you cast out is supposed to come back to you times three. That's what the lady in the magic store said. So what she gets, in addition to his love, is his obsession, is he's thinking about her constantly, following her around, doing whatever he said. She starts to feel bad. She feels like, you know, she's humiliating him and stuff. But when she agrees to go out with him, he assaults her and he tries to rape her, and she has to fight him off, and he's screaming for her in the night. And I thought, you know, this is a love spell, and I know it's supposed to come back to you times three in a bad way, but I already feel that teenage culture conflates sex and love so poorly. It's really troubling to me that in his love for her, it came off as assault. Would you assault someone you love? Like, I've been in love, and yeah, you want to be with them in the physical sense, but you'd never want to hurt them.
I agree. I think watching it and growing up with it, it's such a scary scene because you're asked to, I think, as an audience member, really identify with Sarah. And it's a very intense scene when he's grabbing at her and like forcing her to the ground and chasing her. And it's really upsetting in a lot of ways. And then, of course, Portishead starts playing. So, you know you're fucked at that point. But yeah, I think there isn't that kind of obsessive love. But I think the film ultimately wanted to go to that really dark place. And I think without that scene, if he'd just kind of been this puppy in love with her, like intensely in love with her, but if there hadn't been that assault where we saw how aggressive he could be sexually, because there is still part of him that is him, if we hadn't seen that, then Nancy going off on him in that incredible way, it wouldn't have been quite as powerful. I don't think it would have meant as much.
So in the end, everything returns to normal, like peace and order is restored. Sarah, who is a natural witch and is naturally endowed with her beauty and her political power, except that she's a woman, oh well, gets to go on with her life as she was. Bonnie and Rochelle, who were just apparently playing house, lose their powers and no harm, no foul. Nancy, who got too greedy about it, will spend the rest of her life in a loony bin. But I feel like it's worth noting in the next couple of films we're going to get into, we're going to talk about historical witchcraft. We're going to talk about the depiction of witches and how they've changed throughout the years. But this, as a teen film, it does fetishize the fact that these are lovely teenage girls. And, you know, it's got the iconic walking down the hall in slow-mo scene in their little schoolgirl uniforms. And they were outcasts, but insofar as their wishes were granted, they kind of got this power that was very fetishized and sexy and playful and alluring in their power. And I feel like that's worth mention.
Yeah, I think that during this time, like especially in the early 90s, third wave feminism really came about, and that's when it was named. And there are a lot of facets to third wave feminism, and I cannot give them all enough credence right now. But, you know, I think a big part of that is that women can be so many different things, and we are not only equal and we are not only smart and capable, but we can also be sexy and we can also like clothes and like boys, and it doesn't make us any less smart or interesting or charismatic. So I think that idea of these girls who, at least for a brief time, really come together and we see that bond and, you know, those scenes when they're having the sleepovers, I think it has to be said there's a real chemistry between those four actresses. And I feel like they probably got along really well. And, you know, that's how it feels like at the best moments of being a teenager, when you hang out and you meet like-minded people. And it feels, for a little bit at least, that everything might just be okay. What I kind of took away from it, looking back on it now, and it's one of those movies I'm really glad I watched a lot, even though I think, as we've touched on, there are a lot of problems with it. But those moments when they get along and they're powerful in that right way, that's about being a good feminist. You are an ally to other women. And if you don't like someone, you just back off, and that's okay. But ultimately, it's about helping and respecting other people.
I guess that's why, looking back on it, it seems like almost such a shame that they couldn't kind of get through it together and learn their lessons and stay friends. So moving on, the next film we're going to talk about is going to make The Craft seem like Sunday morning cartoons. The next film that we wanted to talk about with regard to witchcraft is Lars von Trier's film Antichrist.
Close your eyes. Tell me what you see.
My fault.
I want to die too.
Stay with me. Stay with me. Your thoughts distort reality. That's what fear is.
I love you. Let's make a list of things you're afraid of. Where would you feel most exposed?
The woods.
What scares you about the woods?
Everything.
Is it any woods in particular?
Eden.
Imagine you're at Eden. Imagine you arrive at Eden through the woods. Tell me, what do you see?
Darkness comes early down here. I heard a sound. The cry of all the things that are to die. Ground is burning.
The ground is not burning. I've just been having a lot of crazy dreams.
Do you love me? Help me. You said you wanted to help me! Where are you? Nature is Satan's church.
The evil you talk about is an obsession.
No!
Did you want to kill me?
Not yet.
Antichrist is my first Lars von Trier film. When Alex and I were talking about which movies we wanted to cover, she's like, we really need to do this one. And so I watched it specifically for the podcast. And kind of a funny story. I was talking to her in the morning and I was nervous. Lars von Trier is notorious for very disturbing and crazy visuals. And, you know, you think there are boundaries to what you can see on a screen. And he kind of disproves that. So this was my first viewing and I watched it and I told her I was finished. And she was all over me like, what did you think? How did you like it? What did you like this? Did you see that? What did you think of this? And I was just like, I want to be alone. I turned off my phone and I had to really digest it. And all I could think about was what these poor fuckers at Cannes or whatever must have been like. Imagine being out on a date. Anyway, it is an absolutely amazing film. I am a little bit compelled to see the rest of his films. I don't think they're quite as dark, but they're every bit as imaginative. But Antichrist is definitely not for the faint of heart. Make sure you are rested. Make sure you are fed. Check your blood sugar and sit down and check this out. Now, we've got a cast of mainly two played by Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe. And they're actually unnamed throughout the film. So we're just probably going to refer to them as him and her and his and hers because that's just the easy way to do it. Now, the film starts with a slow-mo montage of the two of them having sex in the shower. It's a little bit more graphic than maybe I'd like.
It's a little P in the V.
It's precisely a P in the V. I remember I complained to Alex. I was like, I'm watching this while I'm eating. And she's like, well, it's not his. And I'm like, it's still really explicit. Anyways, as these two are enjoying very passionate black and white slow-mo coitus, their young infant son has made his way to the window of their three-story Manhattan apartment and plummets down to his death. And so right away, it sets the stage for a horrible tragedy. And the first maybe hour of the film is about him and her coping with the loss of their son. He is a therapist, and even though it's admitted throughout the film that you're not supposed to treat your own family, he's going to help her through her grief. And the depiction of grief, let me tell you, it is gutting. I am not a mother. I have never had the horrible misfortune of losing someone close to me, but Jesus Christ, this film tore my heart out and stomped on it. So in the beginning, you kind of figure that that's what the film is about, but then it takes this turn. in her therapy, he uncovers that she has a tremendous fear of their cottage, which is a cabin in the woods that they refer to as Eden. And she has a horrible fear of the cabin and of certain natural landmarks around it. So they decide to go to the cabin to confront her fears. And when they get there, it's revealed that she spent last summer at this cabin in Eden with their son to work on her thesis, which was entitled Gynocide. And so obviously it's assumed that her fear of the cabin has to do with horrible repressed memories of her last summer with her son. But she starts behaving increasingly erratically until it explodes in this absolute lunacy. I don't know how much detail I want to give because I would sound crazy to describe what happens in this film. But basically, we slowly learn that there is a force in the woods and also in her research that comes to possess her off and on throughout the film.
If I may, it's almost like a female version of Jack Torrance.
That's actually really apt. And so in this film, the theme of witchcraft is definitely in there. It's one of those films that we could spend an entire podcast picking apart the minutiae and looking at this represents this and maybe this represents this. But Alex and I already talked about we don't want to do that. First of all, because Lars von Trier is readily acknowledged as a very expressionist and random filmmaker. To do that would be giving the film more analysis than went into the writing of it. So we don't want to do that.
And I, unlike Andrea, I'm actually a really big fan of Lars von Trier. I should qualify that. I don't know if anyone can be a quote-unquote fan of his films, but I appreciate them, and I've really sought them out. And I think, just as Andrea was saying, if we overanalyze it, that takes away from your personal understanding of these films. And what I think von Trier constantly tries to do is ask you to engage with the most horrific parts of humanity. So it's never an easy watch. It's nothing I like. I'm like, oh, I'm bored. I should throw on Melancholia. It's like I have to prepare myself. Or I have to go in blind and just watch it and experience it. So I really felt that this was an important one to bring into the discussion of witches because it deals with them in an unnamed way. You know, like how The Walking Dead, they never truly say zombies. This is the witch equivalent to that. But I feel like there is a real understanding of the history of witches and the history of the persecution of women, which is so much into the idea of the witch, that they are forever inextricably linked if you're willing to look hard enough. And I think this is a film that really confronts a lot of us with a lot of really fucking hard truths. So that's why it's not an easy watch, but if you're game and if you're open and you haven't seen it, I think you gotta try it.
So the female character, her academic discipline isn't mentioned, but her thesis is called gynocide, G-Y-N-O-C-I-D-E, which is actually a word I was unfamiliar with prior to recording this podcast. I actually thought it was a made-up word that she made up for the title of her thesis. And no, it's not. The actual definition is the killing of women or girl. Gynocide is a thing. So I imagine androcide is a thing and suicide. Like, these are all little Latin bits of words that come together to make what we recognize to be English. Now, I listened to a review of this film from a prominent BBC film reviewer named Mark Kermode, and he says that it's a film about misogyny, which I would absolutely agree with. But then he goes on to say that the film itself is misogynist, which I actually strongly disagree with. I think the film confronts a lot of the challenges and contradictions inherent with modern day women in the wake of the Inquisition and the Salem witch trials and the whole witch hunt. That was actually a huge historical blight against women as a whole, against paganism as a way of life. If we can conceive of gynocide as an actual historical event, the witch trials would be it.
I 100% agree with Andrea, and one of the things I really love about von Trier is that he's always labeled as these things, and I think if anything, he just presents us with the really fucked up hard truths that we are faced with every day, and he asks us to interpret them, and I think if anything, he shows them to us in a really horrific way so that we understand by watching Antichrist that misogyny is bad, that the persecution of women is bad. I think the idea that this film is not only representing misogyny, but that it is misogynist in and of itself, comes from a point when the she character actually says that women are evil.
If human nature is evil, then that goes as well for the nature of...
of the women. Female nature.
The nature of all the sisters. Women do not control their own bodies. Nature does. I have it in writing in my books.
The literature that you used in your research was about evil things committed against women, but you read it as proof of the evil of women? You were supposed to be critical of those texts. That was your thesis. Instead, you're embracing it. Do you know what you're saying?
Forget it. I don't know why I said it.
Now, this book she's referring to, it does really exist. I'm sure if you're keen enough, you can go seek it out. It's from a book called Hammer of Witches by a fella named Heinrich Kramer from 1485. And the direct quote that seems to be attributed to Xi's comment in Antichrist is thus: "Women are by nature instruments of Satan, by nature carnal and a structural defect rooted in original creation." So, of course, this goes straight into the idea that Eve was tempted by the snake and ate the apple first, and then coerced Adam, so that women are inherently flawed, we are inherently treacherous, and we are never to be trusted.
And what the Hammer of Witches actually was it was a handbook for people during the Inquisition. It basically had the questions you would ask an accused witch, but it also had the answers. And what they would do is just torture the living shit out of these women until they confessed to the same story. And the story was always the same. So basically, this woman in her remote cabin with her young son was reading all this hateful, hateful propaganda. Propaganda that was misogynist, that was hateful against women and sought to persecute them just for being women, just for what they were. And then we have this horrible event in her life where she's having sex while her child is killed. So we have her guilt at being an unfit mother compounded with the preternatural guilt of enjoying sexuality, which is something that Western culture still propagates.
It was my fault.
What about me? I was there too.
I could have stopped him.
No.
That guilt compounded leaves her with this tremendous confusion, and through the latter half of the film, she kind of oscillates between loathing herself and loathing her sexuality and buying into all this hateful propaganda and simultaneously rallying against it, trying to take comfort from her husband, trying to help herself and survive this. So it's really complicated.
All of what Andrea just said feeds into it, and then the fact that you have on top of it that notion of therapy and that notion of control, and if we can reason our way out of it, you will be cured. There is a very patriarchal notion in that whole curing thing, and there are several scenes where Willem Dafoe is really kind of going through the steps with Charlotte Gainsbourg. He's making her do all the appropriate school-taught things that you would do to someone in distress. But I think what begins to happen is she's developed a complete psychological break that has to do with the guilt of the death of her son. She is no longer able to reconcile her true self, a self that felt okay and felt comfortable in this nature, with all of the feelings she is supposed to have had due to the death of her son. I think for me, and perhaps this is a reach, but hopefully you'll all stay with me, there is a mention, and it's kind of a fleeting thing, before they go out to Eden, Willem Dafoe's character receives the coroner's report of the death of their son, and it explains everything that happened, and everything's kind of on the level, except for one little thing. There's a weird abnormality in his feet, and he notices it and then moves on, and then he sees his wife's research. He understands that the whole summer she was up there with their son by themselves, where he had no part in it. She was putting his shoes on the wrong feet.
You aware that you put Nick's shoes on wrong in this picture?
So well. How weird. of the mind that day. I wish.
It's a very small thing, but it's created a deformity and perhaps, in my mind, suggests that she was never meant to be a mother. And that is, I think, a choice that every woman has to make at some point in their lives. And thankfully, we are now allowed to make that choice. But perhaps that was not part of her plan, and that the fact that she was kind of roped into it through, you know, being the wife of a prominent doctor and being the one who was just doing her grad school research, that that was her role. And I think internally she was rebelling against it.
Nature as a theme features prominently in this film, partly because Eden, their cottage, is Eden. It's the site of paradise that woman spoiled by eating the forbidden fruit. But I also found it really interesting at the beginning of the film when she is in the hospital and he wants to get her out of there because he insists that her condition not be medicalized and that it's something in her head, which to me kind of speaks to the whole nature thing.
I had a talk with Wayne. I think he gives you too much medication, way too much.
Stop it, please. Trust others to be smarter than you.
He's straight out of medical school. He doesn't know what he's doing. I've treated 10 times as many patients as he has.
But you're not a doctor.
No, I'm not. And I'm proud that I'm not when I meet a doctor like him. There is nothing atypical about your grief.
There's nothing physically wrong with you. There is nothing in your nature. It is in society. It is in expectations of you, and it is in how you internalize those expectations. There was a Black Museum lecture last night on cults, and it was an excellent, excellent lecture by Allison Lang. And maybe by the time this podcast is up, video download will be available on the website. But they were often talking about how when people came out of these cults and were recovering, they were being deprogrammed. And every time she said deprogrammed in the lecture, I thought, well, you mean reprogrammed.
If anything, I would say right now, Andrea should have done a mic drop with our mic and walked away, but our mic is bound up by many things, so I'm glad she didn't. I think it's the idea, just as Andrea was saying, that she bought into the patriarchy. She bought in. She tried to be the good wife. She tried to be all these things, but it never worked out for her. She kind of kept hitting walls. And what's interesting is that as really this is kind of the beginning of, you know, the last third of the movie when things really start going off the rails, and Willem Dafoe's character goes up into this attic space where he finds Charlotte Gainsbourg's writing. And it starts off as kind of this writing with some collage and all of these witch trial images, and it's very upsetting. And then the more he flicks through, the more it becomes just scribbles. And just again, as Wendy Torrance looked over Jack Torrance's papers that he'd written, it's that sense of nothing is to be trusted about this person. Nothing that character who is married to the quote-unquote crazy person knows to be real is actually real. And that is, it just spins the whole movie on its head. And I think that's actually quite brilliant. One of the things that's important to note, and this has been brought up in a couple other essays about Antichrist, and if you've guessed already, there are so many people are writing theses on this film and all of Ron Trier's films. So there's so much writing about his stuff. We encourage you to seek it out for yourself. But one of the things that is mentioned is the idea of the attic and the idea of placing the woman in the attic, especially the crazy woman. Now, Charlotte Bronte's book, Jane Eyre, posited that really clearly back in like the 1800s, where Jane Eyre, this tough heroine, went off to live with Mr. Rochester. And the whole time he literally has his crazy wife living in an attic. And that's where you get a great short story like Yellow Wallpaper. There is a real understanding of that this is a part of a woman that is kept locked away if she is kept down or if she is forbade to be who she is or have any kind of experience other than what society has dictated.
That's right. And what the film has in common with The Craft and with the next film that we're going to talk about, and possibly any film that tackles witchcraft in any really meaningful way, is it shows the paradox of women's sordid history as a people. And it sounds crazy to talk about women as a people because we are not a homogenous group per se, but Western women can kind of look back on the witch trials as something that really changed the face of what it meant to be a woman forevermore. these stories about women who are disenfranchised, trying to gain power through being a mother and being popular and being this and being that, and how problematic and complicated these things are.
Obviously, we have to talk about this film in the context of misogyny. We've already talked about it, and I think to wrap up the discussion of this film, we have to kind of end on it. Now, one of the biggest emblems of misogyny to people who believe this to be a misogynist film is the fact that the title is Antichrist, and that the female symbol is placed into the word. So a lot of people associate with the idea that woman is devil. And it's right there, it's right in the title. How could you ignore that? But I think that's the idea of, if you buy into the history of what Christianity has done, that does not negate all of the horrible things that have happened due to the subjugation of other people through this religion. So the idea is not woman as devil, it is the idea of woman as other. And in this case, it is woman as other against a Christian patriarchal society, so that woman as other is not other. It's actually just herself.
That's absolutely right. And I frankly see a lot of satire in the title and throughout the entire movie. And even when she is confused, and it's almost like she's buying into the Christian propaganda when she says women is evil. So I think that's bang on. But anyway, that is a really heavy film. I think I'm glad we talked about it. My head hurts. I don't know about you. It's heavy stuff. And now we're going to get on to considerably lighter fare.
Is it?
Yeah.
That film is Rob Zombie's Lords of Salem from 2013.
Hi. Are you the new tenant? I just saw the tenant like 10 minutes ago standing in the doorway.
Oh, I hate to break it to you, but there is no person in number 5.
You have to understand that there is a war waging in heaven.
On a rare occasion, a special child appears.
Is everything all right?
No.
The curse, the Lords of Salem, possessing the souls of the Salem women, which the devil's child would inherit the earth.
Satan, come to us!
God does not spare angels when they sin.
Lords of Salem is about a woman named Heidi, and she is a radio DJ in Salem, Massachusetts. She and her two co-hosts, Whitey and Herman, have this really raucous, kind of fun, very clip-oriented radio show. Thankfully, we don't have one like that, but they really go whole hog with that. It's like real classic rock stuff.
I actually think their radio show is absolutely unbearable with all the sound effects. First of all, because I'm watching it and I'm like, how unrealistic is it that these sound effects are popping out as they're recording and not in post-production and editing? First of all. Second of all, could you imagine what this podcast would be like if there was a sound effect for everything we said?
So they have this really fun, really stereotypical radio show. And then Heidi gets a package delivered specifically to her from the Lords. and it's a record, and she plays it, and it's just this weird droning sound. She feels weird when she plays it, but we as an audience become aware of the fact that Heidi's coming out of something. She's coming out of what is eventually revealed to be, or is implied to be, some kind of addiction. So that's why Whitey, who is in love with her and she's in love with him, but they don't seem to ever really connect, truly, he seems to be very concerned about her and watching out for her. So they have a man named Francis on the radio show to talk about the history of witches. And they go through this interview and they're kind of mocking him and playing up that he thinks Heidi might be cute, and all these really loud sound effects are going off. But then they play this record on air from the Lords, and we begin to see all these women who hear this broadcast just kind of stop what they're doing and stand and stare. So it's having some kind of impact on the local women of Salem and on their life. As the film progresses, Heidi becomes more and more entrenched in this. And she lives in this kind of amazing loft, but it's part of a house, and there's supposed to be another tenant down the hall, which she sees, but her landlord, a woman named Lacey, keeps saying, no, there's no one up there, there's no one up there. And Heidi just devolves deeper into this psychosis, and she becomes more withdrawn so that everyone around her, except for Lacey and her quote-unquote sisters, begins to see this as her relapse into drug addiction, and indeed, she does relapse into her drug addiction. Now, Lacey and her two sisters, Sunny and Megan, begin to really prey, in a sense, on Heidi and involve her in this stuff and in all this really heinous imagery and witchcraft, until Heidi is completely dissolved into it. And her parallel between being a drug addict and totally ensconced in this world that these women have created for her becomes inseparable. Whitey constantly tries to pull her out of it, but is unable to. Now, what is revealed in the final third of the film is that Heidi is actually a descendant of the Reverend Hawthorne, who was one of the persecutors of the original witches of Salem. What happens in this crazy montage of images is that not only does Heidi seemingly give birth to some kind of alien entity or some kind of anti-human entity, she is also portrayed as the Madonna, as a kind of anti-Madonna, this very punk rock, neon-lit Madonna that has given birth to a new generation. After the credits begin to roll, we learn that the women who were in attendance, and seemingly it was only women who were in attendance at that night, all committed some kind of mass suicide, and that Heidi is actually missing.
So right off the bat, I think I've said it before in previous episodes, but say what you will about Rob Zombie, I think he's a very visual filmmaker, and I think his vision is really fucking cool. It's always really punk rock. It's always really gritty. It's always really rooted in music. And so the fact that this movie culminated into this montage of crazy fucked up scenes, I really enjoyed it. Now, Rob Zombie's shortcomings as a filmmaker are also very apparent in this film. The dialogue ranges from wince-worthy to maybe acceptable. His casting of his wife, Sherry Moon Zombie, in the film, I think it's her best performance to date. I think it's her best role to date. You know, I'll give her that, that for once she's not playing a fucking idiot or a complete psychopath. But I feel like Rob Zombie was in the past maybe criticized a bit for gratuitous showings of her ass and her body. And in this film, he kind of played with that a bit. Did you get that sense?
Well, all I know is I only saw her ass like two or three times, so...
There are these butt shots that are so superfluous and random and contribute nothing to anything that you have to think that it's an inside joke somewhere or something. Like, that's my only explanation for it. But I also have to say that as a character, this DJ Heidi, you know, she's covered in tattoos. Her style is very retro. She's got dreads, for fuck's sake. Like, they really construct her as a woman who lives... according to her own rules, she's very independent. It's just her and her dog. She knows that Whitey kind of loves her, and she kind of loves him too, but she's so fiercely independent that she doesn't want to let him into her shit. And I actually saw a lot of myself in Heidi, and I really enjoyed this film overall.
Yeah, I think it was a really positive portrayal of a woman going through something, and I think it was actually quite surprising having that come from Rob Zombie. Now, I do have to say that one of the filmmakers we get asked most about in all of your feedback to us is Rob Zombie. He is the person that has come up the most, and will you talk about him, and how will you talk about him? So, hey guys, this is how we're talking about him right now. I think one of the most important things and what Lords of Salem does that we haven't already touched on is it implicates the innocent, quote unquote. And that is the fact that these original witches, these witches from Salem who were burned at the stake, cursed the township of Salem that their daughters would be prosecuted or would be maligned in some way due to their transgression. So the sins of the parents being revisited on the children. This is a very common theme in horror, but we're seeing it played out, I think, in a really different way. We have Heidi, you know, centuries later, living her life, doing what she can, and maybe struggling in a lot of different ways, but being hounded by this past that she can't escape and this past wrongdoing. Not only is she hounded for her past wrongdoing, she's actually deified into this Madonna figure, as we mentioned, that she is going to be the leader or this glorified vision of what this group or what this cult has set out to do.
Yeah, I found it really interesting that they set her up as the descendant of the Reverend Hawthorne, and the Reverend Hawthorne was the pious motherfucker who was speaking out against these witches and wouldn't rest until they all burned, especially their leader, Margaret Morgan. And I thought it was really interesting that Heidi herself was so counterculture, you know, like rocking to the beat of her own drum. And she's exactly the kind of other in society that would have been burned as a witch back in those days. So you would almost expect the descendant of Reverend Hawthorne to be maybe a very pious lady, but she's not. So I thought that was a really interesting take on it.
As I write these very words, the witch, Margaret Morgan, gathers with her coven of six deep within the woods surrounding our beloved Salem. The blasphemous music echoes in my mind, driving me to the point of insanity. I, Jonathan Hawthorne, swear before the eyes of God on this day in the year of our Lord 1696 to destroy all persons which choose to pledge allegiance to the demon Satan and his spectral army.
I also thought it was really interesting that in the films that we talked about previously, Antichrist and The Craft, they both likened witchcraft to the origin of witchcraft, which is pagan religion, which is very nature worshipping and close to nature and having to do with nature. Whereas in Lords of Salem, all of the scenes depicting the witches had them depicted as hideous hags, terrorizing newborns with their crazy messed up rituals and hexing people and spitting and giving the evil eye. So it's actually a very conventional view of witchcraft, which I thought was really interesting for such an unconventional film.
Yeah, I think the idea of moral panic plays in really well to this film. Now, moral panic was a term that was coined in 1830 in the aptly named the Quarterly Christian Spectator. And there's a real sense that if you can quell what is defying your, you know, norm, then you'll be okay. So the idea that these kind of crazy hag-like women who weren't attached and weren't married and like doing all these really evil, weird things, if they could be quelled, then everything would be okay. And the fact that it is, as Andrea just said, revisited on an alternative young woman, that's actually quite profound, and that there's still a need to quash out what is different or what is transgressive in our culture.
So we need to talk a little bit more about her landlady. Her landlady, Lacey, throughout, she's a bit maternal toward Heidi. She's the kind of landlady who's always at the foot of the stairs and is going to ask how your day was, which Heidi fields with grace and to some extent gratitude. But when Lacey has her little friends over and they invite Heidi in to talk, things get weird and kind of intense. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it's always about three women. There's always this trifecta, the Holy Trinity,
beginning, middle, end.
Exactly. And I thought it was interesting that played out in this film as well. Now, when Frances, who is, you know, I thought it was actually really problematic the way the author Frances heard the Lords of Salem ditty, his interest in the topic and how he traced it back, I thought was really specious and kind of weak and not heavily developed. But he goes to visit Heidi and instead is intercepted by Lacey, Sunny, and Megan, who kill him. And that's actually where I believe some of the worst dialogue I have ever heard comes into play.
I think you've come here to get inside my dear little Heidi's head. Get inside her head and fuck her brain. Have you come here to stick your nosy cock inside her head and fuck her brain, Mr. Matthias?
I think I should go.
But it actually culminates into this giant montage of a crazy acid trip. She gives birth to this thing that kind of looks like a cross between a turnip and the thing from John Carpenter's film.
Yeah, I think that's where they got the idea for Prometheus.
Oh, fuck, I hate that movie so much. I can't believe you just brought that into it. Now, I have here that Rob Zombie had complete creative freedom for this project, something that he apparently didn't have for Halloween. And I don't know if that's what made Halloween bad. I don't know if that's what prevented it from being worse. It's kind of tough to say. But I have a quote here about Rob Zombie saying of Lords of Salem that it's like if Ken Russell directed The Shining.
God damn it, Rob Zombie. You make it so hard. One thing that we have to consider, and one of the things that I think is really great to talk about with this film, is its specification to location. Now, that is, of course, Salem and the town of Salem, which is a little bit outside of Boston in the States. Now, America has, as every country does, it has a really trying history. It has a history of colonialism and subjugation and persecution. And it's always this idea that as progressive and as free thinking as we might be, our ancestors weren't. So we are always trying to make amends for the sins of our parents and the sins of the past. Now, what I really loved about Lords of Salem, and I thought this film did it really clearly, Frances, the witch historian and witch writer, has a wife or girlfriend who is from Venezuela, and the soundtrack of The Lords doesn't seem to affect her at all. And that goes into play with that these Morgan sisters really, really targeted the daughters of Salem. That notion that these people, this specific group of settlers, wronged these women, so that is who the retribution is going to be taken out against. And I thought, in a very perverse and maybe strange way, that was actually quite fair.
Now, my take on the ending scene, which obviously is very confusing, and for a film that's largely linear up until that point, it can be a bit jarring, but my take was just that the vengeance of Margaret Morgan was that the women of Salem should gather and bear witness to the birth of the Antichrist, who was born by one of them. That's how I saw it.
No, I agree with that. I think my problem with this film kind of does come in that ending. And Andrea and I, last week actually, were talking with Andrea's roommate, who had seen Lords of Salem at TIFF, and he didn't remember the ending credits of the film where it's that newscast going over the events that have played out.
8:45, and this is a WIQZ news break.
The dead bodies of 32 female members of the Salem Historical Lifer Society were discovered this morning in what appears to be an apparent mass suicide. The gruesome scene was discovered in the early morning hours by Donald Felix, a janitor at the Salem Palladium.
At first, I thought there were mannequins left on the stage, you know, but as I got closer, I could see they were real. It was a gruesome display, man. I don't know. I just called 911.
I think that's really important to keep in mind, because if you end on this really trippy experimental thing, then it's like, okay, I can kind of ride that. I can kind of go with it. But then when you have a real life situation and something setting it in a real world, that actually leaves me with way more questions that totally takes the enjoyment out of it. So that if what Andrea's roommate says is true, then that sounds like studio interference or someone just trying to come in and say that, no, this actually does need a clear conclusion. And we need to know to a certain extent what happened to everyone who was there.
So anyway, we picked these three films as three films that illustrate different facets to the wonderful and sordid and complicated history of witchcraft in North America. So I think right now what we're going to do is we're going to scale it back. We're going to take it back maybe 300-400 years to the actual Salem witch trials and talk a bit about what went on and how these films inform our understanding and our remembering of that.
So the European witch trials went on for just over 400 years, and there are varying statistics of how many women were tried and persecuted and eventually died because of these. And, you know, in our real world context, it's a very scary thing because a lot of mental tactics were used on them, and it was really instilled a fear in women of not wanting to step out of line, not wanting to give up that role of childbearer and caregiver that is so much a part of us. And it's still a really amazing part of being a woman. But as I would like to believe, and as I've said before, this is a choice that a woman now can make, is that we don't have to do that. But at that time, that was our one real power. And I think a lot of that actually has to come from kind of pre-medieval time, when a lot of people, actually everyone, did not know how babies were really made. They just came from within women. And men kept boinking women because it felt really good. And it took a little while to figure it out. But there was always that suspicion that the male species, everything is on the exterior. Everything's laid out. It's all there. I understand it. When you're a woman, everything happens internally. And I think that's why women can actually form such close bonds, is because we have all this crazy stuff happening that isn't recognized in a larger context. And this is actually what we talked about, I believe it was in episode 10, when we talked about menstruation in horror films, that need to understand something. But again, a pre-medieval period, men were the norm. That was what happened. That's who went off and fought wars. And women were meant to bear children. Now, this is also kind of playing into the idea of witches at this time and the spread of Christianity, which really distrusted a lot of pagan and more natural beliefs and religions. And the fact that the power, the quote-unquote power of a witch, came from an internal thing, that that had to be stamped out and quashed out. And that actually became very scary, because I think that's when you start to see a lot of women relegating their opinions and their own self-worth to fit into a status quo.
Now, to set the stage a little bit sociologically for, like, we're talking around 17th century here. Now, in these feudal times, as Alex said, women were kind of shrouded in mystery. They were responsible for childbirth, and then there was nursing, and so they were responsible for everything that could not be explained in the world, and that was a lot, because they didn't know a lot about what was going on. But these were also really superstitious times, and women were responsible for the traditions and customs and things that you would do to bring about good crops, to bring about good health and healing and stuff like that. They were very superstitious times. And as such, when things were good, women were praised. And when things were bad, it was vice versa. Women were blamed, and their superstitions were blamed. So the allegations of witchcraft came hand in hand with political and social upheaval and hardship. You had Calvinism emerging and tremendous friction between Calvinism and pagan nature religions. And when I say pagan nature religions, I mean even Christmas, the fact that we decorate a tree and sing songs, like these have their roots in paganism, and Calvin was staunchly against that. So in trying to stamp out those old traditions, women were largely at the root of it all. Now, a lot of what I know about the Salem witch trials is informed by, I had an education in sociology, as you know, but I think I took only two proper women's studies credits, and one of them was called Witchcraft, Magic, and the Occult, and the school kind of knew this credit to be a joke. Like, it was kind of one of those little slippery credits that filled up right away the first day of registration. So I actually took it in the summertime, because that was the only time I was able to register. And we went in and we sat in a hall of maybe 300 19-year-olds, and we listened to this woman talk, and she told the most interesting stories, and then the exams came out and they were multiple choice. And if you were there and you gave half a fuck. You knew the answer. And I actually got 100% in that class. I actually got that on my transcript. I scored it perfect just because I was so interested in it. But a film that was shown in both my feminist studies credits, including Witchcraft, Magic, and the Occult, was a film called The Burning Times. And I definitely want to send you guys a link to this because the entire thing is on YouTube. It's a very feminist and pro-pagan program, and that comes through really strongly. It's very critical of Christianity and critical of the Christian movement, maybe more so than I'd like. I like to look back on history as times of political and social conflict, and different parties came on top one over the other. I don't think anyone set out to quash women as a voice or as a culture, but I think that was the result of these superstitious times going awry. But if you take a look at this documentary, you have a really interesting account on what the Inquisition was like for these women.
When a woman was accused of being a witch and went in front of the Inquisition, she'd be in jail, first of all. She may have been tortured first. Would have been out in the town square or in front of the town church. Because we're not talking about cities. This all happened in rural areas. Most of the witches were in rural areas, almost all of them. So it's a small town thing. Everybody comes out to look. The witch is brought out. She is, first of all, stripped of her clothes because she may have a spell in her clothes or something sewn into the hem, which is made out of the skin of an unbaptized child or something like that. So she's stripped of all her clothes. She's shaved. Both the hair on her head and her pubic hair are shaved because hair has always been thought to have a lot of power, even, you know, we know the myths of Samson and so on. But also that women, when they braided their hair, were thought to braid men's fate with this kind of thing. So it was a magic technique. So she had all her hair removed. But she had to approach the Inquisitor walking backwards so she can't give him the evil eye. And the Inquisitor is somebody who is from the city. He's been appointed by the church or in later times by the ruler or whoever was in charge. So this poor rural woman who turns around to face this man that she may never have seen anything like that before in her life, he probably speaks much better French or English or whatever than she does. So the witch approaching the Inquisitor is just totally dumbfounded, has no idea what's happening to her.
So, and just as Andrea's background, as you know, is in sociology, hopefully you also know that my background is in performance theory. So I have spent a lot of time thinking about one fella in particular named William Shakespeare. He probably has, I would say, one of the most iconic portrayals of witches in his stage play, Macbeth.
Toad that under cold stone days and nights hath 31.
Sweltered venom sleeping got, boil thou first in the charmed pot.
Eye of newton, toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog.
Adder's fork and blind worm sting, lizard's leg and owlet's wing.
Now, if you're really keen, you can go watch the Roman Polanski version because it was produced by Playboy, so you get a lot of witchy boobs in that. So that was a really clear crystallization of the Christian portrayal of witches. They were old and haggard, and if they were sexual, then they were deviant, and they were something to be feared. We go through, you know, the Burning Times, and we go through the Salem witch trials, and I think then the most iconic portrayal of witches actually becomes something from a little studio named Disney, and the portrayal of witches through films like Sleeping Beauty and Snow White, where you have these women who can become old and haggard, but are obsessed with their beauty and youth, and they are in fact childless, so they tend to try to steal a lot of children. And there's a real suspicion around that. And again, you're talking, you know, 1930s through the 50s of these kind of portrayals. So there is a real anxiety around that kind of uncoupled woman.
Seize that creature!
Stand back, you fools!
But I think one of the most redeeming things that I've seen in recent months, and I'm not sure if I'm going to go see it, but I'm going to try, is the new film that's coming out this summer, the big Disney offering, which is Maleficent, starring Angelina Jolie.
shall bestow a gift on the child.
Before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she will fall into a sleep like death.
Curious little beastie. Bring her to me.
I know you're there. Don't be afraid.
I am not afraid.
Then come out.
Then you'll be afraid.
All the other fairies fly. Why don't you?
I had wings once. They were strong. But they were stolen from me. There is evil in this world. Hatred and revenge.
Bring me her head.
I call on those who live in the shadows. Fight with me now!
Is it true? Are you Maleficent?
Now, this seems to be, again, I haven't seen it, it's not quite out yet, but it seems to be a portrayal of the kind of iconic Maleficent character from the Sleeping Beauty fairy tale as perhaps a wronged being. She is fighting against something. Something was taken away from her. And there's a sense that she and perhaps Sleeping Beauty are going to fight back against a more male-dominated society.
It's actually really interesting because a couple of years ago, I checked out the musical Wicked. I was still living in Ottawa, so I guess it was about maybe 6 years ago, but it is tremendously sympathetic to the Wicked Witch of the West, who is named in this play, and she's named Elphaba. And basically, Elphaba goes to an academy for young witches, not unlike Harry Potter or whatever. And she's actually roommates with Glinda the Good Witch, who is so cheerful and dumb that they have this duality and dichotomy. And Elphaba wants nothing more than to work with the Wizard of Oz, who she admires and respects so much. But she realizes throughout the play that she has to compromise a lot of her beliefs and behavior and values in order to work with the wizard, so she rebels. And there's a song where she very clearly says, you know, fuck it, if they're going to call me wicked, then let them call me wicked, but I'm doing what's right. So I do think that there is a contemporary reclaiming of the term witch and problematizing the old Disney conceptions, which is really exciting and really about fucking time.
Yeah, I think a lot of marginalized cultures have really taken on the idea of the witch and that it is an iconoclast figure that has been subjugated, but should now actually be celebrated. And I think we're seeing this. We started seeing it with, gosh, things around the time of the craft, like Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which was all about fun and a bit more Clueless. I mean, the movie Clueless.
Oh, as if!
As well as that Aaron Spelling series Charmed, and then more recently with the American Horror Story third season of Coven. Also a new series that's coming out called Salem, and that seems to be about the Salem witch trials and that there are actually witches present and their interaction with them, which actually also American Horror Story deals with. So there is a real reclaiming of this culture and this idea of the subjugated woman or the outcast in a really powerful way, in a contemporary way, which I think is really incredible and actually very important.
And it'll be interesting to monitor how these portrayals are played out, because like I said before, a lot of women's power that was subjugated back in the burning times had to do with nature and things that science didn't know or didn't care to explain. And so now that science has pretty much explained everything, the source of women's power is largely problematized, and it's a little bit harder to put your finger on. So we picked out three different examples of a really disenfranchised group of women and how they embrace witchcraft, some of them voluntarily and some of them involuntarily, as a source of power that frightens and confuses and contradicts what they know to be true. There are countless examples. I wish we could have talked about Suspiria. We thought about talking about it, but I think that film is more meant to be seen than talked about and discussed, I hate to say. I really enjoy it, but I don't think it really informs a lot of what we're talking about.
One of my favorite portrayals of witches, I love all three and really happy we talked about all three of them, but I love the portrayal of witches as other in Rosemary's Baby. Again, that's one of my favorite movies, and all of them witches. It just really crystallized that fear in the 60s, that distrustworthiness of that whole hippie culture and that kind of happy clappiness of it all. And I thought that was a really brilliant realization of it.
I also really loved the witch. And do you remember Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? There was that horrible, scary witch, and she was in love with the sheriff. And I always thought she was such a tragic figure. First of all, because she had this unrequited love for the handsome sheriff of Nottingham, played by Alan Rickman.
Locksley! I'm gonna cut your heart out with a spoon!
Basically, she existed as someone they came to for help, and she gave them not only the answer they needed, but a strategy on how to circumvent the overthrowing of Nottingham, and they didn't listen to her. I thought she was the most tragic figure of the film. So in conclusion, I know this episode might have seemed a bit random and all over the place, but the history and mythology of witchcraft is a very contentious and contested and ever-changing thing. So we know we have terrific listeners, and I'm really looking forward to the discussions that this will incite. If you want to bring in different films and different permutations of the witch to discuss, we would be so happy to talk about it with you.
I think watching these films back to back really, for me, illuminated the denial of the self. And that's not just for women. That's for men and women. Now, in The Craft, you have Sarah, who, as a young woman, recognizes and is actually forced to realize her power and becomes a really incredible protagonist. For all the problems of that movie, I'm glad that I took away something that a woman can be on her own and powerful and doesn't actually need that much else. And I think the other two films, so you've got Antichrist and Lords of Salem, were about the denial of these characters' true selves. So they didn't actually acknowledge their own needs and wants and felt forced into a role they weren't ready to play. So as we've already talked about, this is a huge topic, and between Andrea and I, we can't possibly know everything, but we hope we've illuminated some things for you, and please interact with us and add to the conversation if you have something to say, because I hope, as you can see, this is a huge topic. We're still kind of hoping we captured everything we wanted to talk about in all these films, and we're very pleased to have brought this to you.
So you can engage with us through the usual channels. There's our Facebook page, we're on Twitter, and our brand spanking new website, facultyofhorror.com. And if you like us, please consider dropping a quick review. And all the bad girls out there,
office hours are closed.